11. Jake heard them coming again. Come, come, Kamala. Heard them promising to eat his balls and drink his blood. Brag, 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 he thought. But tried to run faster anyway. He was alarmed to find he couldn't. Doing the mind swap with Oi had tired him out quite a little bit. No. Roland had taught him that self-deception was nothing but pride in disguise and indulgence to be denied. Jake had done his best to heed this advice and as a result admitted that being tired no longer described his situation. The stitch in his side had grown fangs that had sunk deep into his armpit. He knew he had gained on his pursuers. He also knew from the shouted cadence chant that they were making up the distance they'd lost. Soon they would be shooting at him and Oi again, and while men didn't shoot for shit while they were running, someone could always get lucky. Now he saw something up ahead, blocking the corridor. A door. As he approached it, Jake allowed himself to wonder what he'd do if Susanna wasn't on the other side, or if she was there but didn't know how to help him. Well, he and Oi would make a stand, that was all. No cover. No way to reenact Thermopylae Pass this time, but he'd throw plates and take heads until they brought him down. If he needed to, that was. Maybe he would not. Jake pounded toward the door, his breath now hot in his throat, close to burning, and thought, it's just as well. I couldn't have run much further anyway. Oi got there first. He put his front paws on the ghostwood and looked up as if reading the words stamped into the door and the message flashing below them. Then he looked back at Jake, who came panting up with one hand pressed against his armpit and the remaining arisers clanging loudly back and forth in their bag. North Central Positronics Limited. New York, FedEx. Maximum security. Verbal entry code required. Number 9, final default. He tried the doorknob, but that was only a formality. When the chilly metal refused to turn in his grip, he didn't bother trying again, but hammered the heels of both hands against the wood instead. Susanna, he shouted. If you're there, let me in. Not by the hair of my chinny-chin-chin, he heard his father say. And his mother, much more gravely, as if she knew storytelling was serious business, I heard a fly buzz when I died. From behind the door, there was nothing. From behind Jake, the chanting voices of the Crimson King's posse swept closer. Susanna! He bawled, and when there was no answer this time, he turned, put his back to the door, hadn't he always known it would end just this way with his back to a locked door, and seized an Ariza in each hand. Oi stood between his feet, and now his fur was bushed out, now the velvety soft skin of his muzzle wrinkled back to show his teeth. Jake crossed his arms, assuming the load. Come on then, you bastards, he said. For Gilead and the Eld, for Roland, son of Stephen, for me and Oi. At first he was too fiercely concentrated on dying well, of taking at least one of them with him. The fellow who'd told him the fada was dinner would be his personal preference, and more if he could. To realize the voice he was hearing had come from the other side of the door rather than from his own mind. Jake, is it really you, Sugar Pie? His eyes widened. Oh, please, let it not be a trick. If it was, Jake reckoned that he would never be played another. Susanna, they're coming. Do you know how? Yes, should still be Chasset, do you hear me? If Nigel's right, the word should still be Chasset. Jake didn't give her a chance to finish saying it again. Now he could see them sweeping toward him, running full out, some waving guns and already shooting into the air. Chasset, he yelled. Chasset for the tower. Open, open, you son of a bitch. Behind his pressing back, the door between New York and FedEx clicked open. At the head of the charging posse, Flaherty saw it happen, uttered the bitterest curse in his lexicon, and fired a single bullet. He was a good shot, and all the force of his not inconsiderable will went with that particular slug, guiding it. No doubt it would have punched through Jake's forehead above the left eye, entering his brain and ending his life, had not a strong brown-fingered hand seized Jake by the collar at that very moment and yanked him backward through the shrill elevator shaft whistle that sounds endlessly between the levels of the dark tower. The bullet buzzed by his head instead of entering it. Oi came with him, barking his friend's name shrilly, "Ache, ache, ache, ache!" and the door slammed shut behind them. Flaherty reached it 20 seconds later and hammered on it until his fists bled. When Lamla tried to restrain him, Flaherty thrust him back with such ferocity that the Taheen went a sprawl. But there was nothing he could do. Hammering did not work. Cursing did not work. Nothing worked. At the very last minute, The boy and the bumbler had eluded them. For yet a little while longer, the core of Roland's quartet remained unbroken. Chapter 6 On Turtleback Lane 1 See this, I do beg you, and see it very well, for it's one of the most beautiful places that still remain in America. I'd show you a homely dirt lane running along a heavily wooded switchback ridge in western Maine, its north and south ends spilling onto Route 7 about 2 miles apart. Just west of this ridge, like a jeweler's setting, is a deep green dimple in the landscape. At the bottom of it, the stone in the setting, is Kaiser Lake. Like all mountain lakes, it may change its aspect half a dozen times in the course of a single day, for here the weather is beyond prankish. You could call it half mad and be perfectly accurate. The locals will be happy to tell you about ice cream snow flurries that came to this part of the world once in late August, that would be 1948, and once spang on the glorious 4th, 1959. They'll be even more delighted to tell you about the tornado that came blasting across the lake's frozen surface in January of 1971, sucking up snow and creating a whirling mini-blizzard that crackled with thunder in its middle. Hard to believe such crazy Jane weather, but you could go and see Gary Barker, if you don't believe me. He's got the pictures to prove it. Today the lake at the bottom of the dimple is blacker than homemade sin. Not just reflecting the thunderheads massing overhead, but amplifying their mood. Every now and then a splinter of silver streaks across that obsidian-looking glass as lightning stabs out of the clouds overhead. The sound of thunder rolls through the congested sky west to east, like the wheels of some great stone bucket rolling down an alley in the sky. The pines and oaks and birches are still, and all the world holds its breath. All shadows have disappeared. The birds have fallen silent. Overhead another of those great wagons rolls its solemn course, and in its wake, hark, we hear an engine. Soon enough, John Cullum's dusty Ford Galaxy appears with Eddie Dean's anxious face rising behind the wheel and the headlights shining in the premature gathering dark. 2. Eddie opened his mouth to ask Roland how far they were going, but of course he knew. Turtleback Lane's south end was marked by a sign bearing a large black one, and each of the driveways, splitting off lakeward to their left, bore another higher number. They caught glimpses of the water through the trees, but the houses themselves were below them on the slope and tucked out of sight. Eddie seemed to taste ozone and electric grease with every breath he drew, and twice patted the hair on the nape of his neck, sure it would be standing on end. It wasn't, but knowing it didn't change the nervous, witchy feeling of exhilaration that kept sweeping through him, lighting up his solar plexus like an overloaded circuit breaker, and spreading out from there. It was the storm, of course. He just happened to be one of those people who feel them coming along the ends of their nerves. But never one's approach as strongly as this. It's not all the storm, and you know it. No, of course not. Although he thought all those wild volts might somehow have facilitated his contact with Susanna. It came and went like the reception you sometimes got from distant radio stations at night. But since their meeting with Ye Child of Roderick, Ye Spoiled, Ye Lost, Chevin of Chavin, it had become much stronger. Because this whole part of Maine was thin, he suspected, and close to many worlds. Just as their quartet was close to whole again. For Jake was with Susanna, and the two of them seemed to be safe enough for the time being, with a solid door between them and their pursuers. Yet there was something ahead of those two as well, something Susanna either didn't want to talk about or couldn't make clear. Even so, Eddie had sensed both her horror of it and her terror that it might come back, and he thought he knew what it was. Mia's baby. Which had been Susanna's as well in some way he still didn't fully understand. Why an armed woman should be afraid of an infant Eddie didn't know, but he was sure that if she was, there must be a good reason for it. They passed a sign that said Fen 11, and another that said Israel 12. Then they came around a curve, and Eddie stamped on the Galaxy's brakes, bringing the car to a hard and dusty stop. Parked at the side of the road beside a sign reading Beckhart 13 was a familiar Ford pickup truck and an even more familiar man leaning nonchalantly against the truck's rust-spotted long bed, dressed in cuffed blue jeans and an ironed blue chambray shirt buttoned all the way to the close-shaved, wattled neck. He also wore a Boston Red Sox cap tilted just a little to one side, as if to say, "I got the drop on you, partner." He was smoking a pipe, the blue smoke rising and seeming to hang suspended around his seamed and good-humored face on the breathless pre-storm air. All this Eddie saw with the clarity of his amped-up nerves, aware that he was smiling as you do when you come across an old friend in a strange place, the pyramids of Egypt, the marketplace in old Tangiers, maybe an island off the coast of Formosa, or Turtleback Lane in Lovell, on a thunderstruck afternoon in the summer of 1977. And Roland was also smiling. Old, long, tall and ugly, smiling. Wonders never ceased, it seemed. They got out of the car and approached John Cullum. Roland raised a fist to his forehead and bent his knee a little. "Aye, John. I see you very well."
"Aye, see you too," John Cullum said. "Clear as day."
He skimmed a salute outward from beneath the brim of his cap and above the tangle of his eyebrows. Then he dipped his chin in Eddie's direction.
"Young fella?"
"Long days and pleasant nights," Eddie said, and touched his knuckles to his brow. He was not from this world, not any more, and it was a relief to give up the pretense.
"That's a pretty thing to say," John remarked. Then, "I beat you here. Kind of thought I might."
Roland looked around at the woods on both sides of the road and at the lane of gathering darkness in the sky above it. "I don't think this is quite the place." In his voice was the barest touch of a question.
"Nope, it ain't quite the place you want to finish up," John agreed, puffing his pipe. "I passed where you want to finish up on the way in. And I tell you this, if you mean to palaver, we better do it here rather than there. You go up there, you won't be able to do nothing but gape. I tell you, I ain't never seen the beat of it."
For a moment his face shone like the face of a child who's caught his first firefly in a jar, and Eddie saw that he meant every word.
"Why?" he asked. "What's up there? Is it walk-ins? Or is it a door?"
The idea occurred to him and then seized him.
"It is a door, isn't it? And it's open."
John began to shake his head, then appeared to reconsider.
"Might be a door," he said,
stretching the noun out until it became something luxurious, like a sigh at the end of a long, hard day. "Door.
Doesn't exactly look like a door, but, could be. Somewhere in that light."
He appeared to calculate.
But I think you boys want a palaver, and if we go up there to Kara Laughs, there won't be no palaver. Just you standing there with your jaws dropped."
Cullum threw back his head and laughed.
"Me too."
"What's Kara Laughs?" Eddie asked. John shrugged.
"A lot of folks with lakefront properties name their houses. I think it's because they pay so much for 'em they want a little more back. Anyway, Kara's empty right now. Family named McCrae from Washington, D.C. owns it. But they got it up for sale. They've run onto some hard luck. Fella had a stroke, and she..."
He made a bottle-tipping motion. Eddie nodded. There was a great deal about this tower-chasing business he didn't understand. But there were also things he knew without asking. One was that the core of the walk-in activity in this part of the world was the house on Turtleback Lane John Cullum had identified as Kara Laughs. And when they got there, they'd find the identifying number at the head of the driveway was 19. He looked up and saw the storm clouds moving steadily west above Kaiser Lake. West toward the White Mountains, too, what was almost surely called the Discordia in a world not far from here, and along the path of the beam. Always along the path of the beam.
"What do you suggest, John?" Roland asked.
Cullum nodded at the sign reading Beckhart.
"I've caretook for Dick Beckhart since the late 50s, he said. "Hell of a nice man. He's in Washington now. Doing something with the Carter administration."
Carter.
I got a key. I think maybe we ought to go on down there. It's warm and dry, and I don't think it's going to be either one out here before long. You boys can tell your tale, and I can listen, which is a thing I do tolerably well, and then we can all take a run up to Kara. I just never... He shook his head, took his pipe out of his mouth, and looked at them with naked wonder. I never seen the beat of it, I tell you. It was like I didn't even know how to look at it.
Come on, Roland said. We'll all ride down in your caramobile if it does you.
Does me just fine, John said, and got into the back.
3. Dick Beckhart's cottage was half a mile down, pine-walled, cozy. There was a pot-bellied stove in the living room and a braided rug on the floor. The west-facing wall was glass from end to end, and Eddie had to stand there for a moment looking out in spite of the urgency of their errand. The lake had gone a shade of dead ebony that was somehow frightening, like the eye of a zombie, he thought, and had no idea why he thought it. He had an idea that if the wind picked up, as it would surely do when the rain came, the whitecaps would ruffle the surface and make it easier to look at. Would take away that look of something looking back at you. John Cullum sat at Dick Beckhart's table of polished pine, took off his hat, and held it in the bunched fingers of his right hand. He looked at Roland and Eddie gravely. "We know each other pretty damn well for folks who haven't known each other very damn long," he said. "Wouldn't you say that's so?" They nodded. Eddie kept expecting the wind to begin outside, but the world went on holding its breath. He was willing to bet it was going to be one hellacious storm when it came.
"Folks get to know each other that way in the army," John said. "In the war."
Army. And war, too Yankee for representation.
"Way it always is when the chips are down, I should judge."
"Aye," Roland agreed. "Gunfire makes close relations, we say."
"Do you? Now I know you got things to tell me, but before you start, there's one thing I got to tell you. And I should smile and kiss a pig if it don't please you good and hard."
"What?" Eddie asked.
"County Sheriff Eldon Royster took 4 fellas into custody over in Auburn a couple of hours ago. Seems as though they was trying to sneak past a police roadblock on a woods road and got stuck for their trouble."
John put his pipe in his mouth, took a wooden match from his breast pocket, and set his thumb against the tip. For the moment, however, he didn't flick it, only held it there.
"Reason they's trying to sneak around is they seem to have quite a fair amount of firepower. Machine guns, grenades, and some of that stuff they call C-4. One of them was a fella I believe you mentioned, Jack Andolini."
And with that, he popped the diamond blue tip alight. Eddie collapsed back in one of Cy Beckhart's prim shaker chairs, turned his head up to the ceiling, and bellowed laughter at the rafters. When he was tickled, Roland reflected, no one could laugh like Eddie Dean. At least not since Cuthbert Allgood had passed into the clearing.
"Handsome Jack Andolini, sitting in a county hoosegow in the state of Maine," he said. "Roll me in sugar and call me a fucking jelly donut, if only my brother Henry was alive to see it."
Then Eddie realized that Henry probably was alive right now. Some version of him, anyway. Assuming the Dean brothers existed in this world.
"Yeah, thought it'd please ya," John said, drawing the flame of the rapidly blackening match down into the bowl of his pipe.
It clearly pleased him, too. He was grinning almost too hard to kindle his tobacco.
"Oh, dearie dear," Eddie said, wiping his eyes. "That makes my day, almost makes my year."
"I got something else for you," John said. "But we'll let her be for now."
The pipe was at last going to his satisfaction, and he settled back, eyes shifting between the 2 strange, wandering men he had met earlier that day, men whose car was now entwined with his own, for better or worse, and richer or poorer.
"Right now I'd like to hear your story, and just what it is you'd have me do."
"How old are you, John?"
Roland asked him.
"Not so old I don't still have a little get-up-and-go," John replied, a trifle coldly. "What about yourself, chummy? How many times you ducked under the pole?"
Roland gave him a smile, the kind that said, "Point taken, now let's change the subject."
"Eddie will speak for both of us," he said.
They had decided on this during their ride from Bridgeton. My own tale's too long.
"Do you say so?" John remarked.
"I do," Roland said. "Let Eddie tell you his story as much as he has time for. And we'll both tell what we'd have you do, and then, if you agree, he'll give you one thing to take to a man named Moses Carver, and I'll give you another."
John Cullum considered this, then nodded. He turned to Eddie. Eddie took a deep breath.
"The first thing you ought to know is that I met this guy here in the middle of an airplane flight from Nassau, the Bahamas, to Kennedy Airport in New York. I was hooked on heroin at the time, and so was my brother. I was muling a load of cocaine."
"And when might this have been, son?"
John Cullum asked.
"The summer of 1987.
They saw wonder on Cullum's face, but no shade of disbelief.
"So you do come from the future? Gorry!"
He leaned forward through the fragrant pipe smoke.
"Son," he said, "tell your tale, and don't you skip a goddamn word."
4. It took Eddie almost an hour and a half, and in the cause of brevity, he did skip some of the things that had happened to them. By the time he'd finished, a premature night had settled on the lake below them. And still the threatening storm neither broke nor moved on. Above Dick Beckhart's cottage, thunder sometimes rumbled and sometimes cracked so sharply they all jumped. A stroke of lightning jabbed directly into the center of the narrow lake below them, briefly illuminating the entire surface, a delicate nacreous purple. Once the wind arose, making voices move through the trees, and Eddie thought, "It'll come now. Surely it'll come now." But it did not. Nor did the impending storm leave, and this queer suspension, like a sword hanging by the thinnest of threads, made him think of Susanna's long, strange pregnancy, now terminated. At around 7 o'clock the power went out, and John looked through the kitchen cabinets for a supply of candles, while Eddie talked on. The old people of River Crossing, the mad people in the city of Ludd, the terrified people of Calibrin Sturgis, where they'd met a former priest who seemed to have stepped directly out of a book. John put the candles on the table, along with crackers and cheese and a bottle of red Zinger iced tea. Eddie finished with their visit to Stephen King, telling how the gunslinger had hypnotized the writer to forget their visit, how they had briefly seen their friend Susanna, and how they had called John Cullum because, as Roland said, there was no one else in this part of the world they could call. When Eddie fell silent, Roland told of meeting Chevin of Chavin on their way to Turtleback Lane. The gunslinger laid the silver cross he'd shown Chevin on the table by the plate of cheese, and John poked the fine links of the chain with one thick thumbnail. Then, for a long time, there was silence. When he could bear it no longer, Eddie asked the old caretaker how much of the tale he believed.
"All of it," John said without hesitation. "You got to take care of that rose in New York, don't you?"
"Yes," Roland said.
"Because that's what's kept one of those beams safe while most of the others has been broken down by these, what do you call them, telepathics, the breakers."
Eddie was amazed at how quickly and easily Cullum had grasped that. But perhaps there was no reason to be. Fresh eyes see clear, Susanna liked to say. And Cullum was very much what the Greys of Ludd would have called a trig cove.
"Yes," Roland said, "you say true.
The rose has taken care of one beam. Stephen King's in charge of the other one. At least that's what you think."
Eddie said, "He'd bear watching, John. All else aside, he's got some lousy habits, but once we leave this world's 1977, we can never come back and check on him."
"King doesn't exist in any of these other worlds?" John asked.
"Almost surely not," Roland said.
"Even if he does," Eddie put in, "what he does in them doesn't matter. This is the key world, this and the one Roland came from. This world and that one are twins."
He looked at Roland for confirmation. Roland nodded and lit the last of the cigarettes John had given him earlier.
"I might be able to keep an eye on Stephen King," John said. "He don't need to know I'm doing it, either. That is, if I get back from doing your cussed business in New York. I got me a pretty good idea what it is, but maybe you'd better spell it out."
From his back pocket he took a battered notepad with the words "Mead Memo" written on the green cover. He paged most of the way through it, found a blank sheet, produced a pencil from his breast pocket, licked the tip, Eddie restrained a shudder, and then looked at them as expectantly as any freshman on the first day of high school.
"Now, dearies," he said, "why don't you tell your Uncle John the rest?"
5. This time, Roland did most of the talking, and although he had less to say than Eddie, it still took him half an hour, for he spoke with great caution, every now and then turning to Eddie for help with a word or phrase. Eddie had already seen the killer and the diplomat who lived inside Roland of Gilead, but this was his first clear look at the envoy, a messenger who meant to get every word right. Outside, the storm still refused to break or to go away. At last the gunslinger sat back. In the yellow glow of the candles, his face appeared both ancient and strangely lovely. Looking at him, Eddie for the first time suspected there might be more wrong with him than what Rosalita Munoz had called the dry twist. Roland had lost weight, and the dark circles beneath his eyes whispered of illness. He drank off a whole glass of the red tea at a single draught, and asked, "Do you understand the things I've told you?"
"Aye."
"No more than that." "Ken it very well, do you?" Roland pressed. "No questions?"
"Don't think so."
"Tell it back to us, then." John had filled 2 pages with notes in his looping scrawl. Now he paged back and forth between them, nodding to himself a couple of times. Then he grunted and returned the pad to his hip pocket. "He may be a country cousin, but he's a long way from stupid," Eddie thought. And meeting him was a long way from just luck. That was Ka having a very good day.
"Go to New York," John said. "Find this fella Aaron Deepno. Keep his buddy out of it. Convince Deepno that taking care of the Rose and that vacant lot is just about the most important job in the world."
"You can cut the just about," Eddie said. John nodded as if that went without saying. He picked up the piece of notepaper with the cartoon beaver on top and tucked it into his voluminous wallet. Passing the bill of sale to him had been one of the harder things Eddie Dean had had to do since being sucked through the unfound door and into East Stoneham, and he came close to snatching it back before it could disappear into the caretaker's battered old Lord Buxton. He thought he understood much better now about how Calvin Tower had felt.
"Because you boys now own the lot, you own the Rose," John said.
"The Tet Corporation now owns the Rose," Eddie said, "a corporation of which you're about to become executive vice president." John Cullum looked unimpressed with his putative new title. He said,
"Deepno's supposed to draw up articles of incorporation and make sure Tet's legal. Then we go to see this fella, Moses Carver, and make sure he gets on board. That's apt to be the hard part."
"Hard part.
But we'll give it our best go."
"Put Auntie's cross around your neck," Roland said, "and when you meet with Cy Carver, show it to him. It may go a long way toward convincing him you're on the straight. But first, you must blow on it, like this." On their ride from Bridgeton, Roland had asked Eddie if he could think of any secret, no matter how trivial or great, which Susanna and her godfather might have shared in common. As a matter of fact, Eddie did know such a secret, and he was now astounded to hear Susanna speak it from the cross which lay on Dick Beckhart's pine table. "We buried Pimsy under the apple tree, where he could watch the blossoms fall in the spring," her voice said. "And Daddy Mose told me not to cry any more, because God thinks to mourn a pet too long." Here the words faded away, first to a mutter and then to nothing at all. But Eddie remembered the rest and repeated it now.
"To mourn a pet too long's a sin. She said Daddy Mose told her she could go to Pimsy's grave once in a while and whisper, 'Be happy in heaven,' but never to tell anyone else, because preachers don't hold much with the idea of animals going to heaven, and she kept the secret. I was the only one she ever told."
Eddie, perhaps remembering that post-coital confidence in the dark of night, was smiling painfully. John Cullum looked at the cross, then up at Roland, wide-eyed.
"What is it?" Some kind of tape recorder? It ain't, is it?
It's a sigil, Roland said patiently. One that may help you with this fellow Carver, if he turns out to be what Eddie calls a hard-ass.
The gunslinger smiled a little. Hard-ass was a term he liked, one he understood.
Put it on.
But Cullum didn't, at least not at once. For the first time since the old fellow had come into their acquaintance, including that period when they'd been under fire in the general store, he looked genuinely discomposed.
"Is it magic?"
he asked. Roland shrugged impatiently, as if to tell John that the word had no useful meaning in this context, and merely repeated, "Put it on." Gingerly, as if he thought Aunt Talitha's cross might glow red-hot at any moment and give him a serious burn, John Cullum did as bid. He bent his head to look down at it, momentarily giving his long Yankee face an amusing burger's double chin, then tucked it into his shirt.
"Gorry," he said again, very softly.
6. Aware that he was speaking now as once he'd been spoken to, Eddie Dean said, "Tell the rest of your lesson, John of East Stoneham, and be true." Cullum had gotten out of bed that morning no more than a country caretaker, one of the world's unknown and unseen. He'd go to bed tonight with the potential of becoming one of the world's most important people, a true prince of the earth. If he was afraid of the idea, it didn't show. Perhaps he hadn't grasped it yet. But Eddie didn't believe that. This was the man Ka had put in their road, and he was both trig and brave. If Eddie had been Walter at this moment, or Flag, as Walter sometimes called himself, he believed he would have trembled.
"Well," John said, "it don't mind a mite to you who runs the company, but you want Tet to swallow up Holmes, because from now on the job doesn't have anything to do with making toothpaste and capping teeth, although it may go on looking that way yet a while."
"And what's—" Eddie got no further. John raised a gnarled hand to stop him. Eddie tried to imagine a Texas Instruments calculator in that hand, and discovered he could, and quite easily. Weird.
"Give me a chance, youngster, and I'll tell you."
Eddie sat back, making a zipping motion across his lips.
"Keep the rose safe. That's first. Keep the writer safe. That's second. But beyond that, me and this guy Deepnow and this other guy, Carver, are supposed to build up one of the world's most powerful corporations. We trade in real estate. We work with,
He pulled out the battered green pad, consulted it quickly, and put it away.
"We work with software developers, whatever they are, because they're going to be the next wave of technology. We're supposed to remember three words." He ticked them off. "Microsoft, microchips, Intel. And no matter how big we grow, or how fast, our three real jobs are the same. Protect the Rose, protect Stephen King, and try to screw over two other companies every chance we get. One's called Sombra, others—"
There was the slightest of hesitations.
"The other's North Central Positronics. Sombra's mostly interested in property, according to you fellas. Positronics, well, science and gadgets, that's obvious even to me. If Sombra wants a piece of land, Tet tries to get it first. If North Central wants a patent, we try to get it first, or at least to frig it up for them. Throw it to a third party if it comes to that."
Eddie was nodding approval. He hadn't told John that last. The old guy had come up with it on his own.
"We're the three toothless musketeers, the old farts of the apocalypse, and we're supposed to keep those two outfits from getting what they want by fair means or foul. Dirty tricks most definitely allowed."
John grinned.
"I never been to Harvard Business School."
"Harvard Business School.
But I guess I can kick a fella in the crotch as well as anyone."
"Good," Roland said. He started to get up.
"I think it's time we—"
Eddie raised a hand to stop him. Yes, he wanted to get to Susanna and Jake, couldn't wait to sweep his darling into his arms and cover her face with kisses. It seemed years since he had last seen her on the East Road in Caliburn Sturgis. Yet he couldn't leave it at this as easily as Roland, who had spent his life being obeyed and had come to take the death allegiance of complete strangers as a matter of course. What Eddie saw on the other side of Dick Beckhart's table wasn't another tool but an independent Yankee who was tough-minded and smart as a whip, but really too old for what they were asking. And speaking of too old, what about Aaron Deepno, the chemotherapy kid?
"My friend wants to get moving, and so do I," Eddie said. "We've got miles to go yet."
"I know that. It's on your face, son, like a scar."
Eddie was fascinated by the idea of duty and car as something that left a mark, something that might look like decoration to one eye and disfigurement to another. Outside, thunder cracked and lightning flashed.
"But why would you do this?" Eddie asked. "I have to know that. Why would you take all this on for two men you just met?"
John thought it over. He touched the cross he wore now and would wear until his death, in the year of 1989, the cross given to Roland by an old woman in a forgotten town. He would touch it just that way in the years ahead when contemplating some big decision. The biggest might have been the one to sever Tet's connection with IBM, a company that had shown an ever-increasing willingness to do business with North Central Positronics. Or preparing for some covert action, the firebombing of Sombra Enterprises in New Delhi, for instance, in the year before he died. The cross spoke to Moses Carver and never spoke again in Cullum's presence, no matter how much he blew on it. But sometimes, drifting to sleep with his hand clasped around it, he would think, "'Tis a sigil. Tis a sigil, dear, something that came from another world." If he had regrets toward the end, other than about some of the tricks, which were filthy indeed and cost more than one man his life, it was that he never got a chance to visit the world on the other side, which he glimpsed one stormy evening on Turtleback Lane in the town of Lovell. From time to time, Roland Sigel sent him dreams of a field filled with roses and a sooty black tower. Sometimes he was visited by terrible visions of two crimson eyes floating unattached to anybody and relentlessly scanning the horizon. Sometimes there were dreams in which he heard the sound of a man relentlessly winding his horn. From these latter dreams he would awake with tears on his cheeks, those of longing and loss and love. He would awake with his hand closed around the cross, thinking, "I denied Discordia and regret nothing. I have spat into the bodiless eyes of the Crimson King and rejoice. I threw my lot with the gunslingers Ka Tet and the White, and never once questioned the choice." Yet for all that, he wished he could have walked out just once into that other land, the one beyond the door. "Now," he said, "you boys want all the right things. I can't put it any clearer than that. I believe you." He hesitated. "I believe in you. What I see in your eyes is true." Eddie thought he was done, and then Cullum grinned like a boy. "Also, it 'pears to me you're offering the keys to one humongous great engine."
Engine?
Who wouldn't want to turn it on and see what it does?
"Are you scared?" Roland asked.
John Cullum considered the question, then nodded.
"Yeah," he said.
Roland nodded.
"Good," he said.
7. They drove back up to Turtleback Lane in Cullum's car beneath a black, boiling sky. Although this was the height of the summer season and most of the cottages on Kayser were probably occupied, they saw not a single car moving in either direction. All the boats on the lake had long since run for cover.
"Said I had something else for you," John said,
and went to the back of his truck where there was a steel lockbox snugged up against the cab. Now the wind had begun to blow. It swirled his scanty fluff of white hair around his head. He ran a combination, popped a padlock, and swung back the lockbox's lid. From inside he brought out two dusty bags the wanderers knew well. One looked almost new compared to the other, which was the scuffed no-color of desert dust, and laced its long length with rawhide.
"Our gunner!"
Eddie cried, so delighted and so amazed that the words almost came out in a scream.
"How in the name of hell—"
John offered them a smile that augured well for his future as a dirty trickster. Bemused on the surface, sly beneath.
Nice surprise, ain't it? Thought so myself. I went back to get a look at Chip's store, what is left of it, while there was still a lot of confusion. People running hither, thither, and yon, is what I mean to say. Covering bodies, stringing that yellow tape, taking pictures. Somebody had put those bags off to one side, and they looked just a dite lonely. So I... He shrugged one bony shoulder. I scooped him up.
This would have been while we were visiting with Calvin Tower and Aaron Deepno in their rented cabin, Eddie said. After you went back home, supposedly to pack for Vermont, is that right?
He was stroking the side of his bag. He knew that smooth surface very well. Hadn't he shot the deer it had come from and scraped off the hair with Roland's knife and stitched the hide himself, with Susanna to help him? Not long after the great robot Bear Shardik had almost unzipped Eddie's guts, that had been. Sometime in the last century, it seemed.
"Yeah," Cullum said, and when the old fellow's smile sweetened, Eddie's last doubts about him departed. They had found the right man for this world.
Say true and thank Dan, big, big.
"Strap on your gun, Eddie," Roland said, holding out the revolver with the worn sandalwood grips.
"Mine. Now he calls it mine."
Eddie felt a small chill. "I thought we were going to Susanna and Jake." But he took the revolver and belted it on willingly enough.
Roland nodded, "But I believe we have a little work to do first. Against those who killed Callahan and then tried to kill Jake."
His face didn't change as he spoke, but both Eddie Dean and John Cullum felt a chill. For a moment, it was almost impossible to look at the gunslinger.
So came, although they did not know it, which was likely more mercy than such as they deserved, the death sentence of Flaherty, the Tahin Lamla, and their quartet.
8. "Oh, my God," Eddie tried to say, but no sound came out. He had seen brightness growing ahead of them as they drove north along Turtleback Lane, following the one working taillight of Cullum's truck. At first he thought it might be the carriage lamps guarding some rich man's driveway, then perhaps floodlights. But the glow kept strengthening, a blue-golden brilliance to their left, where the ridge sloped down to the lake. As they approached the source of the light, Cullum's pickup now barely crawling, Eddie gasped and pointed as a circle of radiance broke free of the main body and flew toward them, changing colors as it came, blue to gold, to red, red to green, to gold, and back to blue. In the center of it was something that looked like an insect with four wings. Then, as it soared above the bed of Cullum's truck and into the dark woods on the east side of the road, it looked toward them, and Eddie saw the insect had a human face.
"What? Dear God, Roland, what?"
"Tahin," Roland said,
and said no more. In the growing brilliance, his face was calm and tired. More circles of light broke free of the main body and streamed across the road in cometary splendor. Eddie saw flies and tiny jeweled hummingbirds and what appeared to be winged frogs. Beyond them, the taillight of Cullum's truck flashed bright, but Eddie was so busy goggling that he would have rear-ended the man had Roland not spoken to him sharply. Eddie threw the Galaxy into park without bothering to either set the emergency brake or turn off the engine. Then he got out and walked toward the blacktop driveway that descended the steep wooded slope. His eyes were huge in the delicate light, his mouth hung open. Cullum joined him and stood looking down. The driveway was flanked by two signs: "Kara Laughs" on the left, and 19 on the right.
"Something, ain't it?" Cullum asked quietly.
"You got that right," Eddie tried to reply, and still no words would come out of his mouth, only a breathless wheeze. Most of the light was coming from the woods to the east of the road and to the left of the Kara Laughs driveway. Here the trees, mostly pines, spruces, and birches bent from a late winter ice storm, were spread far apart, and hundreds of figures walked solemnly among them, as though in a rustic ballroom, their bare feet scuffing through the leaves. Some were pretty clearly children of Roderick, and as Runtas Chevin of Chavin. Their skins were covered with the sores of radiation sickness, and very few had more than a straggle of hair, but the light in which they walked gave them a beauty that was almost too great to look upon. Eddie saw a one-eyed woman carrying what appeared to be a dead child. She looked at him with an expression of sorrow, and her mouth moved, but Eddie could hear nothing. He raised his fist to his forehead and bent his leg. Then he touched the corner of one eye and pointed to her. "I see you," the gesture said, or so he hoped. "I see you very well." The woman bearing the dead or sleeping child returned the gesture, and then passed from sight. Overhead, thunder cracked sharply, and lightning flashed down into the center of the glow. An ancient fir tree, its lusty trunk girdled with moss, took the bolt and split apart down its center, falling half one way and half the other. The inside was on fire, and a great gust of sparks, not fire, not this, but something with the ethereal quality of swamp light, went twisting up toward the hanging swags of the clouds. In those sparks, Eddie saw tiny, dancing bodies, and for a moment he couldn't breathe. It was like watching a squadron of Tinkerbells there and then gone.
"Look at 'em," John said reverently. "Walk-ins. Gorry, there's hundreds. I wish my friend Donnie was here to see."
Eddie thought he was probably right. Hundreds of men, women, and children were walking through the woods below them, walking through the light, appearing and disappearing and then appearing again. As he watched, he felt a cold drop of water splash his neck, followed by a second and a third. The wind swooped down through the trees, provoking another upward gush of those fairy-like creatures and turning the tree that had been halved by lightning into a pair of vast, crackling torches.
"Come on," Roland said, grabbing Eddie's arm. "It's going to come a downpour, and this'll go out like a candle. If we're still on this side, when it does, we'll be stuck here."
"Where?" Eddie began, and then he saw, near the foot of the driveway, where the forest cover gave way to a tumble of rocks falling down to the lake, was the core of the glow, for the time being too bright to look at. Roland dragged him in that direction. John Cullum remained hypnotized for a moment longer by the walk-ins, then tried to follow them.
"No!" Roland called over his shoulder.
The rain was falling harder now, the drops cold on his skin and the size of coins.
"You have your work, John. Fare you well."
"And you, boys,"
John called back. He stopped and raised his hand in a wave. A bolt of electricity cut across the sky, momentarily lighting his face in brilliant blue and deepest black.
"And you!"
"Eddie, we're going to run into the core of the light," Roland said. "It's not a door of the old people, but of the prim. That is magic, do you, Ken? It'll take us to the place we want, if we concentrate hard enough."
"Where? There's no time. Jake's told me where, by touch. Only hold my hand and keep your mind blank. I can take us."
Eddie wanted to ask him if he was absolutely sure of that, but there was no time. Roland broke into a run. Eddie joined him. They sprinted down the slope and into the light. Eddie felt it breathing over his skin like a million small mouths. Their boots crackled in the deep leaf cover. To his right was the burning tree. He could smell the sap and the sizzle of its cooking bark. Now they closed in on the core of the light. At first, Eddie could see Kaiser Lake through it, and then he felt an enormous force grip him and pull him forward through the cold rain and into that brilliant, murmuring glare. For just a moment he glimpsed the shape of a doorway. Then he redoubled his grip on Roland's hand and closed his eyes. The leaf-littered ground ran out beneath his feet, and they were flying.
Chapter 7 Reunion 1
Flaherty stood at the New York FedEx door, which had been scarred by several gunshots but otherwise stood whole against them, an impassable barrier which the shitting kid had somehow passed. Lamla stood silent beside him, waiting for Flaherty's rage to exhaust itself. The others also waited, maintaining the same prudent silence. Finally, the blows Flaherty had been raining on the door began to slow. He administered one final overhand smash, and Lamla winced as blood flew from the Hume's knuckles.
"What?" Flaherty asked, catching his grimace. "What? Do you have something to say?"
Lamla cared not at all for the white circles around Flaherty's eyes and the hard red roses in Flaherty's cheeks. least of all for the way Flaherty's hand had risen to the butt of the Glock automatic hanging beneath his armpit.
"No," he said. "No, Si."
"Go on, say what's on your mind, do it please you," Flaherty persisted. He tried to smile and produced a gruesome grin instead, the leer of a madman. Quietly, with barely a rustle, the rest pulled back.
"Others will have plenty to say. Why shouldn't you start, my collie? I lost him. Be the first to carp, you ugly motherfucker."
"I'm dead," Lamla thought. "After a life of service to the king, one unguarded expression in the presence of a man who needs a scapegoat, and I'm dead."
He looked around, verifying that none of the others would step in for him, and then said,
"Flaherty, if I've offended you in some way, I'm sure—"
"You've offended me, sure enough," Flaherty shrieked. "I'm sure I'll pay for tonight's work, but I think you'll pay for—"
There was a kind of gasp in the air around them, as if the corridor itself had inhaled sharply. Flaherty's hair and Lamla's fur rippled. Flaherty's posse of low men and vampires began to turn. Suddenly one of them, a vamp named Albrecht, shrieked and bolted forward, allowing Flaherty a view of two newcomers, men with raindrops, still fresh and dark on their jeans and boots and shirts. There was trail dusty gunner gar at their feet, and revolvers hung at their hips. Flaherty saw the sandalwood grips in the instant before the younger one drew, faster than blue blazes, and understood at once why Albrecht had run. Only one sort of man carried guns that looked like that. The young one fired a single shot. Albrecht's blonde hair jumped as if flicked by an invisible hand, and then he collapsed forward, fading within his clothes as he did so.
"Hail, you bondsmen of the king,"
the older one said. He spoke in a purely conversational tone. Flaherty, his hand still bleeding from his extravagant drumming on the door through which the snot-babby had disappeared, could not seem to get the sense of him. It was the one of whom they had been warned. Surely it was Roland of Gilead, but how had he gotten here, and on their blind side? How? Roland's cold blue eyes surveyed them.
"Which of this sorry herd calls himself Dean? Will that one honor us by stepping forward or not?"
"Not?"
His eyes surveyed them. His left hand departed the vicinity of his gun and journeyed to the corner of his mouth, where a small, sarcastic smile had bloomed.
"Not?
Too bad. Thou art cowards after all, I'm sorry to see. Thee'd kill a priest and chase a lad, but not stand and claim thy day's work. Thou art cowards and the sons of cow—"
Flaherty stepped forward with his bleeding right hand clasped loosely around the butt of the gun that hung below his left armpit in a docker's clutch.
"That would be me, Roland of Stephen."
"You know my name, do you?"
"Aye, I know your name by your face, and your face by your mouth. 'Tis the same as the mouth of your mother, who did suck John Farson with such glee until he spewed his—"
Flaherty drew as he spoke, a bushwhacker's trick he'd no doubt practiced and used before to advantage. And although he was fast, and the forefinger of Roland's left hand still touched the side of his mouth when Flaherty's draw began, the gunslinger beat him easily. His first bullet passed between the lips of Jake's chief harrier, exploding the teeth at the front of his upper jaw to bone fragments, which Flaherty drew down his throat with his dying breath. His second pierced Flaherty's forehead between the eyebrows, and he was flung back against the New York Fedic door with the unfired Glock spilling from his hand to discharge a final time on the hallway floor. Most of the others drew a split second later. Eddie killed the six in front, having taken time to reload the chamber he'd fired at Albrecht. When the revolver was empty, he rolled behind his din to reload, as he had been taught. Roland picked off the next five, then rolled smoothly behind Eddie, who took out the rest, save one. Lamla had been too cunning to try, and so was the last standing. He raised his empty hands, the fingers furry and the palms smooth.
"Will you grant me parole, gunslinger, if I promise you peace?"
"Not a bit," Roland said, and cocked his revolver.
"Be damned to you, then, Cherry Car,"
said the Tahin, and Roland of Gilead shot him where he stood. And Lamla of Galee fell down dead. 2. Flaherty's posse lay stacked in front of the door like cordwood, Lamla face down in front. Not a single one had had a chance to fire. The tile-throated corridor stank of the gunsmoke which hung in a blue layer. Then the purifiers kicked in, chugging wearily in the wall, and the gunslingers felt the air first stirred into motion and then sucked across their faces. Eddie reloaded the gun, his now, so he'd been told, and dropped it back into its holster. Then he went to the dead and yanked four of them absently aside so he could get to the door.
"Susanna! Suze, are you there?"
Do any of us, except in our dreams, truly expect to be reunited with our heart's deepest loves, even when they leave us only for minutes and on the most mundane of errands? No, not at all. Each time they go from our sight, we, in our secret hearts, count them as dead. Having been given so much, we reason, how could we expect not to be brought as low as Lucifer for the staggering presumption of our love? So Eddie didn't expect her to answer until she did, from another world and through a single thickness of wood.
"Eddie? Sugar, is it you?"
Eddie's head, which had seemed perfectly normal only seconds before, was suddenly too heavy to hold up. He leaned it against the door. His eyes were similarly too heavy to hold open, and so he closed them. The weight must have been tears, for suddenly he was swimming in them. He could feel them rolling down his cheeks, warm as blood, and Roland's hand touching his back.
"Susanna,"
Eddie said. His eyes were still closed. His fingers were splayed on the door.
"Can you open it?"
Jake answered,
"No, but you can."
"What word?" Roland asked. He had been alternating glances at the door with looks behind him, almost hoping for reinforcements, for his blood was up, but the tiled corridor was empty. "What word, Jake?" There was a pause, brief, but it seemed very long to Eddie, and then both spoke together.
"Chasset,"
they said. Eddie didn't trust himself to say it. His throat was too full of tears. Roland had no such problem. He hauled several more bodies away from the door, including Flaherty's, his face still fixed in its final snarl, and then spoke the word. Once again, the door between the worlds clicked open. It was Eddie who opened it wide, and then the four of them were face to face again. Susanna and Jake in one world, Roland and Eddie in another, and between them a shimmering, transparent membrane like living mica. Susanna held out her hands, and they plunged through the membrane like hands emerging from a body of water that had been somehow magically turned on its side. Eddie took them. He let her fingers close over his and draw him into Fedic. 3. By the time Roland stepped through, Eddie had already lifted Susanna and was holding her in his arms. The boy looked up at the gunslinger. Neither of them smiled. Oi sat at Jake's feet and smiled for both of them. "Heil, Jake," Roland said.
"Heil, father."
"Will you call me so?"
Jake nodded.
"Yes, if I may."
"Such would please me, ever,"
Roland said. Then slowly, as one performs an action with which he's unfamiliar, he held out his arms. Looking up at him solemnly, never taking his eyes from Roland's face, the boy, Jake, moved between those killer's hands and waited until they locked at his back. He had had dreams of this that he would never have dared to tell. Susanna, meanwhile, was covering Eddie's face with kisses.
"They almost got Jake," she was saying. "I sat down on my side of the door, and I was so tired I nodded off. He must have called me 3-4 times before I—"
Later he would hear her tale, every word, and to the end. Later there would be time for palaver, for now he cupped her breast, the left one, so he could feel the strong, steady beat of her heart, and then stopped her speech with his mouth. Jake, meanwhile, said nothing. He stood with his head turned so his cheek rested against Roland's midsection. His eyes were closed. He could smell rain and dust and blood on the gunslinger's shirt. He thought of his parents, who were lost. His friend Benny, who was dead. The pair, who had been overrun by all those from whom he had so long fled. The man he held had betrayed him once, for the tower had let him fall, and Jake couldn't say the same might not happen again. Certainly they were miles ahead. And they would be hard ones,
Still, for now, he was content. His mind was quiet, and his sore heart was at peace. It was enough to hold and be held. Enough to stand here with his eyes shut, and to think, "My father has come for me." Part 2. Blue Heaven. Divar Toy. Chapter 1. The Divar Titi. 1. The four reunited travelers, five counting Oi of Midworld, stood at the foot of Mia's bed looking at what remained of Susanna's twim, which was to say her twin. Without the deflated clothes to give the corpse some definition, probably none of them could have said for certain what it had once been. Even the snarl of hair above the split gourd of Mia's head looked like nothing human. It could have been an exceptionally large dust bunny. Roland looked down at the disappearing features, wondering that so little remained of the woman whose obsession, the chap, had come so near to wrecking their enterprise for good. And without them, who would remain to stand against the Crimson King and his infernally clever Chancellor? John Cullum, Aaron Deepno, and Moses Carver, three old men, one of them with black mouth disease, which Eddie called "can't, sir." "So much you did," he thought, gazing raptly at the dusty, dissolving face. "So much you did, and so much more you would have done, aye, and all without a check or qualm. And so will the world end, I think. A victim of love rather than hate. For love's ever been the more destructive weapon, sure." He leaned forward, smelling what could have been old flowers or ancient spices, and exhaled. The thing that looked vaguely like a head, even now, blew away like milkweed fluff, or a dandy old ball. "She meant no harm to the universe," Susanna said, her voice not quite steady. "She only wanted any woman's privilege, to have a baby, someone to love and raise."
"Aye," Roland agreed. "You say true, which is what makes her end so black."
Eddie said, "Sometimes I think we'd all be better off if the people who mean well would just creep away and die."
"That'd be the end of us, Big Ed," Jake pointed out.
They all considered this, and Eddie found himself wondering how many they'd already killed with their well-intentioned meddling. The bad ones he didn't care about, but there had been others, too. Roland's lost love, Susan, was only one. Then Roland left the powdery remains of Mia's corpse and came to Susanna, who was sitting on one of the nearby beds with her hands clasped between her thighs.
"Tell me everything that befell since you left us on the East Road after the battle," he said. "We need to—"
"Roland, I never meant to leave you. It was Mia. She took over. If I hadn't had a place to go, a Dogon, she might have taken over completely."
Roland nodded to show he understood that. "Nevertheless, tell me how you came to this Divar Titi. And, Jake, I'd hear the same from you."
"Divar Titi," Eddie said. The phrase held some faint familiarity. Did it have something to do with Chevin of Chavin, the slow mutey Roland had put out of its misery in Lovell? He thought so.
"What's that?"
Roland swept a hand at the room with all its beds, each with its helmet-like machine and segmented steel hose, beds where the gods only knew how many children from the Kalas had lain and been ruined.
"It means little prison, or torture chamber."
"Doesn't look so little to me," Jake said.
He couldn't tell how many beds there were, but he guessed the number at 300. 300 at least.
"Mayhap we'll come upon a larger one before we're finished. Tell your tale, Susanna, and you too, Jake."
"Where do we go from here?" Eddie asked.
"Perhaps the tale will tell," Roland answered.
2. Roland and Eddie listened in silent fascination as Susanna and Jake recounted their adventures, turn and turn about. Roland first halted Susanna while she was telling them of Matthiasen van Wyck, who had given her his money and rented her a hotel room. The gunslinger asked Eddie about the turtle in the lining of the bag.
"I didn't know it was a turtle. I thought it might be a stone."
If you'd tell this part again, I'd hear, Roland said. So, thinking carefully, trying to remember completely, for it all seemed a very long time ago, Eddie related how he and Per Callahan had gone up to the doorway cave and opened the ghostwood box with Black 13 inside. They'd expected Black 13 to open the door, and so it had, but first,
we put the box in the bag, Eddie said. The one that said nothing but strikes at Midtown Lanes in New York, and nothing but strikes at Mid-World Lanes on the Colubrin Sturgis side, remember?
They all did.
And I felt something in the lining of the bag. I told Callahan, and he said—
Eddie mulled it over.
He said, this isn't the time to investigate it, or something like that. I agreed. I remember thinking we had enough mysteries in our hands already. We'd save this one for another day.
Roland, who in God's name put that thing in the bag, do you think?
For that matter, who left the bag in the vacant lot? Susanna asked.
Or the key, Jake chimed in. I found the key to the house in Dutch Hill in that same lot. Was it the rose? Did the rose somehow, I don't know, make them?
Roland thought about it. Were I to guess, he said, I'd say that Cy King left those signs and sigils.
The writer, Eddie said.
He weighed the idea, then nodded slowly. He vaguely remembered a concept from high school, the God from the Machine, it was called. There was a fancy Latin term for it as well, but that one he couldn't remember. Had probably been writing Mary Lou Kenopensky's name on his desk while the other kids had been obediently taking notes. The basic concept was that if a playwright got himself into a corner, he could send down the God, who arrived in a flower-decked bucca wagon from overhead and rescued the characters who were in trouble. This no doubt pleased the more religious playgoers who believed that God, not the special effects version who came down from some overhead platform the audience couldn't see, but the one who weren't in heaven, really did save people who deserved it. Such ideas had undoubtedly gone out of fashion in the modern age, but Eddie thought that popular novelists, of the sort Cy King seemed on his way to becoming, probably still used the technique, only disguising it better. Little escape hatches, cards that read, Get Out of Jail Free, or Escape the Pirates, or Freak Storm Cuts Electrical Power, Execution Postponed. The God from the Machine, who was actually the writer, patiently working to keep the characters safe so his tale wouldn't end with an unsatisfying line like, And so the quartet was wiped out on Jericho Hill, and the bad guys won. Rule Discordia, so sorry, better luck next time. What next time, ha ha, the end. Little safety nets like a key, not to mention a scrimshaw turtle.
If he wrote those things into his story, Eddie said, it was long after we saw him in 1977.
Aye, Roland agreed.
And I don't think he thought them up, Eddie said. Not really. He's just, I don't know, just a bum hug? Susanna asked, smiling. No, Jake said, sounding a little shocked. Not that, he's a sender. A telecaster.
He was thinking about his father and his father's job at the network.
Bingo, Eddie said, and leveled a finger at the boy. This idea led him to another, that if Stephen King did not remain alive long enough to write those things into his tale, the key and the turtle would not be there when they were needed. Jake would have been eaten by the doorkeeper in the house on Dutch Hill, always assuming he got that far, which he probably wouldn't have done. And if he escaped the Dutch Hill monster, he would have been eaten by the grandfathers, Callahan's Type 1 vampires in the Dixie Pig. Susanna thought to tell them about the vision she'd had as Mia was beginning her final journey from the Plaza Park Hotel to the Dixie Pig. In this vision, she'd been jugged in a jail cell in Oxford, Mississippi, and there had been voices coming from a TV somewhere. Chet Huntley, Walter Cronkite, Frank McGee. Newscasters chanting the names of the dead. Some of those names, like President Kennedy and the Diem brothers, she'd known. Others, like Krista McAuliffe, she had not. But one of the names had been Stephen King's. She was quite sure of it. Chet Huntley's partner, good night, Chet, good night, David, saying that Stephen King had been struck and killed by a Dodge minivan while walking near his house. King had been 52, according to Brinkley. Had Susanna told them that, a great many things might have happened differently, or not at all. She was opening her mouth to add it into the conversation,
A falling chip on a hillside strikes a stone, which strikes a larger stone, which then strikes two others and starts a landslide, when there was the clunk of an opening door and the clack of approaching footsteps. They all turned, Jake reaching for Eriza, the others for their guns.
"Relax, fellas," Susanna murmured. "It's all right. I know this guy."
And then, to DNK-45932, domestic, she said,
"I didn't expect to see you again so soon. In fact, I didn't expect to see you at all. What's up, Nigel, old buddy?"
So this time, something which might have been spoken was not. And the deus ex machina, which might have descended to rescue a writer who had a date with a Dodge minivan on a late spring day in the year of 99, remained where it was, high above the mortals who acted their parts below. 3. The nice thing about robots, in Susanna's opinion, was that most of them didn't hold grudges. Nigel told her that no one had been available to fix his visual equipment, although he might be able to do it himself, he said, given access to the right components, disks, and repair tutorials, so he had come back here, relying on the infrared, to pick up the remains of the shattered and completely unneeded incubator. He thanked her for her interest and introduced himself to her friends.
"Nice to meet you, Nige," Eddie said. "But you'll want to get started on those repairs, I can it, so we won't keep you."
Eddie's voice was pleasant, and he'd reholstered his gun, but he kept his hand on the butt. In truth, he was a little bit freaked by the resemblance Nigel bore to a certain messenger robot in the town of Colibrin Sturgis. That one had held a grudge.
"No. Stay," Roland said. "We may have chores for you, but for the time being, I'd as soon you were quiet. Turned off if it please you." "And if it doesn't," his tone implied.
"Certainly, Si," Nigel replied in his plummy British accent. "You may reactivate me with the words, 'Nigel, I need you.'"
"Very good," Roland said.
Nigel folded his scrawny but undoubtedly powerful stainless steel arms across his chest and went still.
"Came back to pick up the broken glass," Eddie marveled. "Maybe the Tet Corporation could sell 'em. Every housewife in America would want two, one for the house and one for the yard."
"The less we're involved with science, the better," Susanna said darkly. In spite of her brief nap while leaning against the door between Fedek and New York, she looked haggard, done almost to death. "Look where it's gotten this world." Roland nodded to Jake, who told of his and Pear Callahan's adventures in the New York of 1999, beginning with the taxi that had almost hit Oi and ending with their two-man attack on the low men and the vampires in the dining room of the Dixie Pig. He did not neglect to tell how they had disposed of Black 13 by putting it in a storage locker at the World Trade Center, where it would be safe until early June of 2002, and how they had found a turtle which Susanna had dropped like a message in a bottle in the gutter outside the Dixie Pig.
"So brave," Susanna said, and ruffled Jake's hair.
Then she bent to stroke Oi's head. The bumbler stretched his long neck to maximize the caress, his eyes half closed, and a grin on his foxy little face.
"So damned brave. Thank you, Si, Jake."
"Thank Ake,"
Oi agreed.
"If it hadn't been for the turtle, they would have gotten us both."
Jake's voice was steady, but he had gone pale.
"As it was, the pair, he—"
Jake wiped away a tear with the heel of his hand and gazed at Roland.
"You used his voice to send me on. I heard you."
I had to," the gunslinger agreed. "'Twas no more than what he wanted."
Jake said,
"The vampires didn't get him. He used my Ruger before they could take his blood and change him into one of them. I don't think they would have done that anyway. They would have torn him apart and eaten him. They were mad."
Roland was nodding.
"The last thing he sent, I think he said it out loud, although I'm not sure. It was—"
Jake considered it. He was weeping freely now.
"He said, 'May you find your tower, Roland, and breach it, and may you climb to the top.' Then—"
Jake made a little puffing sound between his pursed lips.
"Gone, like a candle flame, to whatever worlds there are.
He fell silent. For several moments they all did, and the quiet had the feel of a deliberate thing. Then Eddie said,
"All right, we're back together again. What the hell do we do next?"